collect her things from the St. John's practice. Among them I found a small... He held his fingers some 3 inches apart. Wooden figure. A stylized Viking which she'd been keeping on her desk. Written in ink on this figure's base was Brunhilde, with a small heart. Roy took a sip of coffee. I'd never seen it before. Of course, it's possible that Satchwell was carrying it around with him for years, on the off chance that he'd one day bump into Margot in the street. However, I concluded that they'd seen each other again, and that he'd given her this token, on a subsequent occasion. All I know is I'd never seen it before I collected her things from her surgery. Robin could tell that Anna wanted to suggest an alternative explanation, but it was very difficult to find a flaw in Roy's reasoning.
"Did you tell the police what you suspected?" Strike asked.
"Yes," said Phipps. "And I believe Satchwell claimed that there'd been no second meeting, that he'd given the figure to Margot years before, when they were first involved. They couldn't prove it either way, of course. But I'd never seen it before." Robin wondered which would be more hurtful, finding out that a spouse had hidden a love token from a former partner and taken to displaying it many years later, or that they'd been given it recently.
"Tell me," Strike was saying, "did Margot ever tell you anything about a pillow dream?"
"A what?" said Roy.
"Something Satchwell had told her concerning a pillow."
"I don't know what you're talking about," said Roy suspiciously.
"Did Inspector Talbot ever happen to mention that he believed Satchwell lied about his whereabouts on the 11th of October?"
"No," said Roy, now looking very surprised. "I understood the police were entirely satisfied with his alibi."
"We found out," Strike said, addressing Anna, "that Talbot kept his own separate case notes, separate from the official police record, I mean. After appearing to rule out Ares, he went back to him and started digging for more information on him."
"Ares?" repeated Anna, confused.
"Sorry," said Strike, irritated by his own lapse into astrological speak. "Talbot's breakdown manifested itself as a belief he could solve the case by occult means. He started using tarot cards and looking at horoscopes. He referred to everyone connected with the case by their star signs. Satchwell was born under the sign of Aries, so that's what he's called in Talbot's private notes."
There was a brief silence, and then Kim said, "Jesus wept."
"Astrology," said Roy, apparently confounded. "You see, Dad," said Anna, thumping her knee with her fist,
"if Lawson had taken over earlier..."
"Lawson was a fool," said Roy,
who nevertheless looked shaken.
"An idiot. He was more interested in proving that Talbot had been inept than in finding out what happened to Margot. He insisted on going back over everything. He wanted to personally interview the doctors who treated me for the bleed on my knee, even though they'd given signed statements. He went back to my bank to check my accounts in case I'd paid someone to kill your mother. He put pressure..."
He stopped and coughed, thumping his chest. Cynthia began to rise off the sofa, but Roy indicated with an angry gesture that she should stay put.
"Put pressure on Cynthia, trying to get her to admit she'd lied about me being in bed all that day. But he never found out a shred of new information about what had happened to your mother. He was a Jobsworth, a bullying, unimaginative Jobsworth, whose priority wasn't finding her, it was proving that Talbot messed up. Bill Talbot may have been..." "He clearly was," Roy added, with a furious glance at Strike. "Unwell. But the simple fact remains, nobody's ever found a better explanation than Creed, have they?"
And with the mention of Creed, the faces of the three women on the sofa fell. His very name seemed to conjure a kind of black hole in the room, into which living women had disappeared, never to be seen again. A manifestation of almost supernatural evil. There was a finality in the very mention of him, the monster, now locked away for life, untouchable, unreachable, like the women locked up and tortured in his basement. And Robin's thoughts darted guiltily to the email she had now written and sent, without telling Strike what she'd done, because she was afraid he might not approve.
"Do any of you know," Roy asked abruptly, "who Kara Wolfson and Louise Tucker were?"
"Yes," said Robin, before Strike could answer. "Louise was a teenage runaway, and Kara was a nightclub hostess. Creed was suspected of killing both of them, but there was no proof."
"Exactly," said Roy,
throwing her the kind of look he might once have given a medical student who had made a correct diagnosis.
"Well, in 1978 I met up with Kara's brother and Louise's father."
"I never knew you did that," said Anna, looking shocked.
"Of course not, you were 5 years old," snapped Roy.
He turned back to Strike and Robin.
"Louise's father had made his own study of Creed's life. He'd gone to every place Creed had ever lived or worked and interviewed as many people who'd admit to knowing him. He was petitioning Merlin Reese, the then Home Secretary, to let him go and dig in as many of these places as possible." "The man was half insane," said Roy. "I saw then what living with something like this could do to you. The obsession had taken over his entire life. He wanted buildings dismantled, walls taken down, foundations exposed. Fields where Creed might once have walked dug up. Streams dragged, which some schoolboy friend said Creed might have once gone fishing in. Tucker was shaking as he talked, trying to get me and Wolfson, who was a lorry driver, to join him in a TV campaign. We were to chain ourselves to the railings outside Downing Street, get ourselves on the news. Tucker's marriage had split up. He seemed on bad terms with his living children. Creed had become his whole life."
"And you didn't want to help?" asked Anna.
"If," said Roy quietly, "he'd had actual evidence, any solid clue that linked Margot and Creed.
I've read you thought one of the necklaces in the basement might have been—"
"If you will get your information from sensationalist books, Anna,
because you've always made it so easy for me to talk to you about my mother," said Anna, "haven't you?"
"Anna?"
whispered Cynthia.
"The locket they found in Creed's basement wasn't Margot's, and I should know because I gave it to her," said Roy.
His lips trembled, and he pressed them together.
"Just a couple more questions, if you wouldn't mind," said Strike,
before Anna could say anything else. He was determined to avert further conflict if he could.
"Could we talk for a moment about Wilma, the cleaner who worked at the practice and did housework for you here as well? It was all Margot's idea, hiring her. But she wasn't very good," said Roy. "The woman was having some personal difficulties, and Margot thought the solution was more money. After Margot disappeared, she walked out, never turned up again. No loss. I heard afterwards she'd been sacked from the practice. Pilfering, I heard. Wilma told police that there was blood on the carpet upstairs the day Margot went missing," interrupted Roy.
From Anna and Kim's startled expressions, Robin deduced that this was entirely new information to them.
"Yes," said Strike. "It was menstrual," said Roy coldly. "Margot's period had started overnight. There were sanitary wrappers in the bathroom, my mother told me. Wilma sponged the carpet clean. This was in the spare room at the opposite end of the house to the marital bedroom. Margot and I were sleeping apart at that time because of—"
there was a slight hesitation—
"my injury. Wilma also said that she thought she'd seen you walking across the garden," said Roy. "It was a lie. If she saw anyone, it would have been one of the stonemasons. We were finishing the gazebo at that time," he said,
pointing towards the stone folly at the end of the fish pond. Strike made a note and turned over a page in his notebook.
"Can either of you remember Margot talking about a man called Niccolò Ricci? He was a patient at the St. John's practice."
Both Roy and Cynthia shook their heads.
"What about a patient called Stephen Douthwaite?"
"No," said Roy. "But we heard about him afterwards, from the press.
Someone at the barbecue mentioned that Margot had been sent chocolates by a patient," said Cynthia. "That was him, wasn't it?" We think so. She never talked about Douthwaite then, never mentioned him showing an inappropriate interest in her, or told you he was gay.
No, said Roy again. There's such a thing as patient confidentiality, you know.
This might seem an odd question, said Strike, but did Margot have any scars, specifically on her ribcage?
No, said Roy, unsettled.
Why are you asking that?
To exclude one possibility, said Strike. And before they could ask for further details, he said,
Did Margot ever tell you she'd received threatening notes?
Yes, said Roy.
Well, not notes in the plural. She told me she'd got one.
She did, said Strike, looking up.
Yes. It accused her of encouraging young women into promiscuity and sin.
Did it threaten her?
I don't know, said Roy. I never saw it.
She didn't bring it home?
No, said Roy shortly. He hesitated, then said, We had a row about it.
Really?
Yes. There can be serious consequences, said Roy, turning redder. Societal consequences, when you start enabling things that don't take place in nature.
Are you worried she told some girl it was okay to be gay? Asked Anna.
And yet again Cynthia whispered, Anna.
I'm talking, said Roy, his face congested, about giving reckless advice that might lead to marital breakdown. I'm talking about facilitating promiscuity behind the backs of parents. Some very angry man had sent her that note, and she never seemed to have considered.
Roy's face worked.
For a moment, it looked as though he was going to shout, but then, most unexpectedly, he burst into noisy tears.
His wife, daughter, and daughter-in-law sat, stunned, in a row on the sofa. Nobody, even Cynthia, went to him. Roy was suddenly crying in great heaving gulps, tears streaming down over his sunken cheeks, trying and failing to master himself, and finally speaking through the sobs.
She never seemed to remember that I couldn't protect her, couldn't do anything if somebody tried to hurt because I'm a useless bleeder, useless bloody bleeder.
Oh, Dad, whispered Anna, horrified.
And she slid off the sofa and walked to her father on her knees. She tried to place her hands on his leg, but he batted her consoling hands away, shaking his head, still crying.
No, no, I don't deserve it. You don't know everything. You don't know.
What don't I know? She said, looking scared.
Dad, I know more than you think. I know about the abortion.
There was never, never, never an abortion, said Roy, gulping and sobbing. That was the one thing Una Kennedy and I, we both knew she'd never, never, not after you. She told me, Margot told me, after she had you, changed her views completely, completely.
Then what don't I know? Whispered Anna.
I was cruel to her,
wailed Roy.
I was. I made things difficult, showed no interest in her work. I drove her away. She was going to leave me. I know what happened, I know. I've always known. The day before she went, she left a message in the clock, silly thing we used to do, and the note said, Please talk to me.
Roy's sobs overtook him. As Cynthia got up and went to kneel on Roy's other side, Anna reached for her father's hand, and this time he let her hold it. Clinging to his daughter, he said,
I was waiting for an apology, for going to drink with Satchel, and because she hadn't written an apology, I didn't talk to her. And the next day, I know what happened. She liked to walk. If she was upset, long walks. She forgot about Una, went for a walk, trying to decide what to do. Leave me because I'd made her so sad. She wasn't paying attention, and Creed, and Creed must have.
Still holding his hand, Anna slid her other arm around her father's shaking shoulders and drew her to him. He cried inconsolably, clinging to her. Strike and Robin both pretended an interest in the flowered rug. "Roy," said Kim gently at last, "nobody in this room hasn't said or done things they don't bitterly regret. Not one of us." Strike, who'd got far more out of Roy Phipps than he'd expected, thought it was time to draw the interview to a close. Phipps was in such a state of distress that it felt inhumane to press him further. When Roy's sobs had subsided a little, Strike said formally,
"I want to thank you very much for talking to us, and for the tea. We'll get out of your hair."
He and Robin got to their feet. Roy remained entangled with his wife and daughter. Kim stood up to show them out.
"Well," Kim said quietly, as they approached the front door, "I have to tell you that was, well, close to a miracle. He's never talked about Margot like that. Ever. Even if you don't find out anything else. Thank you. That was healing."
The rain had ceased and the sun had come out. A double rainbow lay over the woods opposite the house. Strike and Robin stepped outside into clean, fresh air.
"Could I ask you one last thing?" said Strike, turning back to Kim, who stood in the doorway.
"Yes, of course."
"It's about that summer house thing in the garden, beside the koi pond. I wondered why it's got a cross of St. John on the floor," said Strike.
"Oh," said Kim. "Margot chose the design. Yes, Cynthia told me ages ago. Margot had just got the job at St. John's. And funnily enough, this area's got a connection to the Knights Hospitaller, too."
"Yes," said Robin. "I read about that at Hampton Court.
So, she thought it would be a nice allusion to the two things. You know, now you mention it, I'm surprised nobody ever changed it. Every other trace of Margot's gone from the house."
"Expensive, though," said Strike, "to remove slabs of granite."
"Yes," said Kim, her smile fading a little. "I suppose it would be."
Chapter 37 Spring-headed hydras and sea-shouldering whales, great whirlpools which all fishes make to flee, bright scolopendres armed with silver scales, mighty monoceros with immeasured tails, the dreadful fish that hath deserved the name of death. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. Rain fell almost ceaselessly into February. On the 5th, the most savage storm yet hit the south. Thousands of homes lost power. Part of the sea wall supporting the London South West Railway line collapsed. Swathes of farmland disappeared under floodwaters. Roads became rivers, and the nightly news featured fields turned to seas of grey water and houses waist-deep in mud. The Prime Minister promised financial assistance. The emergency service scrambled to help the stranded, and high on a hill above the flooded St. Maws, Joan was deprived of a promised visit from Strike and Lucy because they were unable to reach her either by road or train. Strike sublimated the guilt he felt for not heading to Cornwall before the weather rendered the journey impossible by working long hours and skimping on sleep. Masochistically, he chose to work back-to-back shifts so that Barclay and Hutchins could take some of the leave due to them because of his previous trips to see Joan. In consequence, it was Strike, not Hutchins, who was sitting in his BMW in the everlasting rain outside Eleanor Dean's house in Stoke Newington on Wednesday evening the following week, and Strike, who saw a man in a tracksuit, knock on her door and be admitted. Strike waited all night for the man to reappear. Finally, at 6 in the morning, he emerged onto the still dark street with his hand clamped over his lower face. Strike, who was watching him through night vision glasses, caught a glimpse of Eleanor Dean in a cosy quilted dressing gown, waving him off. The tracksuited man hurried back to his Citroen, with his right hand still concealing his mouth, and set off in a southerly direction. Strike tailed the Citroen until they reached Rising Hill Street in Pentonville, where Strike's target parked and entered a modern red-brick block of flats, both hands now in his pockets and nothing unusual about his mouth as far as the detective could see. Strike waited until the man was safely inside, took a note of which window showed a light 5 minutes later, then drove away, parking shortly afterwards in White Lion Street. Early as it was, people were already heading off to work, umbrellas angled against the continuing downpour. Strike wound down the car window, because even he, inveterate smoker though he was, wasn't enjoying the smell of his car after a night's surveillance. Then, though his tongue ached from too much smoking, he lit up again and phoned Saul Morris.
"All right, boss."
Strike, who didn't particularly like Morris calling him boss, but couldn't think of any way to ask him to stop without sounding like a dickhead, said,
"I want you to switch targets. Forget Shifty today. I've just followed a new guy who spent the night at Eleanor Dean's."
He gave Morris the address.
"He's second floor, flat on the far left as you're looking at the building. 40-ish, grey in hair, bit of a paunch. See what you can find out about him. Chat up the neighbours, find out where he works, and have a dig around online. See if you can find out what his interests are. I got a hunch he and SB are visiting that woman for the same reason. See, this is why you're the head honcho. You take over for one night and crack the case."
Strike wished Morris would stop brown-nosing him too. When he'd hung up, he sat smoking for a while the wind nipped at his exposed flesh and rain hit his face in what felt like icy needle pricks. Then, after checking the time to make sure his early rising uncle would be awake, he phoned Ted.
"All right, boy," said his uncle, over the crackling phone line. "Fine. How are you?" "Oh, I'm fine," said Ted. "Just having some breakfast. Joan is still asleep." "How is she?" "No change. Bearing up." "What about food? Have you got enough?" "We're fine for food. Don't you worry about that," said Ted. "Little Dave Polworth come over yesterday with enough food to feed us for a week." "How the hell did he get to you?" asked Strike, who knew that a large chunk of land between his aunt and uncle and Polworth's house was under several feet of water.
"Rolled part of the way," said Ted, sounding amused. "He made it sound like one of his Iron Man competitions. All covered in oilskins he was when he got here. Big backpack full of shopping. He's all right, that Polworth."
"Yeah, he is," said Strike, momentarily closing his eyes.
It oughtn't to be Polworth looking after his aunt and uncle. It should be him. He ought to have left earlier, knowing the weather was looking bad, but for months now he'd been juggling guilt about his aunt and uncle, with the guilt he felt about the load he was putting on his subcontractors, and Robin especially.
"Ted, I'll be there as soon as they put the trains back on."
I know you will, lad," said Ted. "Don't worry about us. I won't take you to her because she needs her rest, but I'll tell her you called. She'll be chuffed."
Tired, hungry, and wondering where he might get some breakfast, Strike typed out a text to Dave Polworth, his cigarette jam between his teeth, using the nickname he'd had for Polworth ever since the latter had got himself bitten by a shark at the age of 18. "Ted's just told me what you did yesterday. I'll never be able to repay all this, chum. Thank you." He flicked his cigarette end out of the car, wound up the window, and had just turned on the engine when his mobile buzzed. Expecting to see a response from Polworth, doubtless asking him when he turned into such a puff or a big girl, Polworth's language being always as far from politically correct as you could get, he looked down at the screen, already smiling in anticipation, and read, "Dad wants to call you. When would be a good time?" Strike read the text twice before understanding that it was from Al. At first, he felt only blank surprise. Then anger and profound resentment rose like vomit.
"Fuck off!"
he told his phone loudly. He turned out of the side street and drove away, jaw clenched, wondering why he should be hounded by Rokeby now of all times in his life, when he was so worried about relatives who'd cared about him, when there'd been no kudos to be gained from the association. The time for amends had passed. The damage was irreparable. Blood wasn't thicker than fucking water. Consumed by thoughts of frail Joan, with whom he shared no shred of DNA, marooned in her house on the hill amid floods, anger and guilt writhed inside him. A matter of minutes later, he realized he was driving through Clerkenwell. Spotting an open cafe on St. John Street, he parked, then headed through the rain into warmth and light, where he ordered himself an egg and tomato sandwich. Choosing a table by the window, he sat down facing the street, eye to eye with his own unshaven and stony-faced reflection in the rain-studded window. Hangovers apart, Strike rarely got headaches, but something resembling one was starting to build on the left side of his skull. He ate his sandwich, telling himself firmly that food was making him feel better. Then, after ordering a second mug of tea, he pulled out his mobile again and typed out a response to Al, with the dual objective of shutting down Rokeby once and for all, and of concealing from both his half-brother and his father how much their persistence was disturbing his peace. "I'm not interested, it's too late. I don't want to fall out with you, but take this no as final." He sent the text, and then cast around immediately for something else to occupy his tired mind. The shops opposite were ablaze with red and pink. February the 14th was almost here. It now occurred to him that he hadn't heard from Charlotte since he'd ignored her text at Christmas. Would she send him a message on Valentine's Day? A desire for contact seemed to be triggered by special occasions and anniversaries. Automatically, without considering what he was doing, but with the same desire for comfort that had pushed him into this cafe, Strike pulled his phone out of his pocket again and called Robin, but the number was engaged. Shoving the mobile back in his pocket, stressed, anxious, and craving action, he told himself he should make use of being in Clerkenwell, now he was here. This cafe was only a short walk from the old St. John's surgery. How many of these passers-by, he wondered, had lived in the area 40 years previously? The hunched old woman in a raincoat with a tartan shopping trolley, the grey-whiskered man trying to flag down a cab, perhaps the ageing Sikh man in his turban, texting as he walked. Had any of them consulted Margot Bamborough? Could any of them remember a dirty, bearded man called something like Applethorpe, who'd roamed these very streets, insisting to strangers that he'd killed the doctor? Strike's absent gaze fell on a man walking with a strange rolling gait on the opposite side of the road. His fine mousy hair was rain-soaked and plastered to his head. He had neither coat nor umbrella, but wore a sweatshirt with a picture of Sonic the Hedgehog on the front. The lack of coat, the slightly lumbering walk, the wide childlike stare, the slightly gaping mouth, the stoic acceptance of becoming slowly drenched to the skin, all suggested some kind of cognitive impairment. The man passed out of Strike's line of vision as the detective's mobile rang. "Hi, did you just call me?" said Robin. And Strike felt a certain release of tension and decided the tea was definitely soothing his head.
"I did, yeah, just for an update."
He told her the story of the tracksuited man who'd visited Eleanor Dean overnight. "And he was covering up his mouth when he left. That's weird."
"I know. There's definitely something odd going on in that house. I've asked Morris to dig a bit on the new bloke."
"Pentonville's right beside Clerkenwell," said Robin.
"Which is where I am right now. Cafe on St. John Street.
I think...
A yawn overtook Strike.
"Sorry. I think, seeing as I'm in the area, I might have another dig around on the late Applethorpe. Try and find someone who remembers the family, or knows what might have happened to them."
"How are you going to do that?"
"Walk the area," said Strike,
and he became conscious of his aching knee even as he said it.
"Have an ask around in any businesses that look long established.
I know.
He yawned again. "It's a long shot, but we haven't got anyone else claiming to have killed Margot."
"Aren't you knackered?"
"Been worse. Where are you right now?"
"Office," said Robin. "And I've got a bit of Bamborough news, if you've got time."
"Go on," said Strike,
happy to postpone the moment when he had to go back out into the rain. "Well, firstly, I've had an email from Gloria Conti's husband, you know, the receptionist who was the last to see Margot. It's short. Dear Mr. Ellicott."
"Mister?"
Robin often confuses people. "I write for my wife, who has been very afflicted by your communications. She has not proofs or information that concern Margot Bamborough, and it is not convenient that you contact her at my offices. Our family is private and desires to remain like that. I would like your assurances that you will not contact my wife another time. Yours sincerely, Hugo Joubert."
"Interesting," agreed Strike, scratching his unshaven chin. "Why isn't Gloria emailing back herself? Too afflicted?"
"I wonder why she's so upset, I mean." "Maybe," Robin said, answering her own question, "because I contacted her through her husband's office, but I tried through Facebook and she wouldn't answer.
You know, I think it might be worth getting Anna to contact Gloria. Margot's daughter might tug at her heartstrings better than we can. Why don't you draft another request and send it over to Anna? See whether she'd be comfortable letting you put her name to it."
"Good thinking," said Robin, and he heard her scribbling a note. "Anyway, in better news, when you called me just now, I was talking to Wilma Bayliss's second oldest daughter, Maya. She's the deputy headmistress. I think I'm close to persuading her to talk to us. She's worried about her older sister's reaction, but I'm hopeful."
"Great," said Strike. "I'd like to hear more about Wilma."
"And there's one other thing," said Robin, "only you might think this is a bit of a long shot."
"I've just told you I'm about to go door to door asking about a dead nutter who definitely wasn't called Applethorpe," said Strike. And Robin laughed.
"Okay, well, I was back online last night, having another look for Steve Douthwaite, and I found this old Memories of Butlin's website, where ex-redcoats chat to each other and reminisce and organise reunions and stuff, you know, the kind of thing. Anyway, I couldn't find any mention of Douthwaite, or Jax, as he was calling himself in Clacton-on-Sea. But I did find... I know it's probably totally irrelevant," she said, "and I don't know whether you remember, but a girl called Julie Wilkes was quoted in Whatever Happened to Margot Bamborough. She said she was shocked that Stevie Jax hadn't told his friends that he'd been caught up in a missing woman case."
"Yeah, I remember," said Strike.
"Well, that girl drowned," said Robin. "Drowned at the holiday camp at the end of the 1985 holiday season. Her body was found one morning in the camp swimming pool. A group of them were discussing her death on the message boards on the website. They think she got drunk, slipped, hit her head, and slid into the pool." "Maybe it's horrible luck," said Robin, "but women do have a habit of dying in Douthwaite's vicinity, don't they? His married girlfriend kills herself, his doctor goes missing, and then there's his co-worker who drowns. Everywhere he goes, unnatural death follows. It's just odd."
"Yes, it is," said Strike, frowning out at the rain.
He was about to wonder aloud where Douthwaite had hidden himself, when Robin said in a slight rush, "Listen, there's something else I wanted to ask you, but it's absolutely fine if the answer's no. My flatmate Max, you know he's an actor, well, he's just been cast in a TV thing as an ex-soldier, and he doesn't know anyone else to ask. He wondered whether you'd come over to dinner so he can ask you some questions."
"Oh,"
said Strike, surprised but not displeased.
"Yeah, okay. When?"
"I know it's short notice, but would tomorrow suit you? He really needs it soon."
"Yeah, that should be all right," said Strike.
He was holding himself ready to travel down to St. Maur's as soon as it became practicable, but the sea wall looked unlikely to be repaired by the following day. When Robin had hung up, Strike ordered a third mug of tea. He was procrastinating, and he knew why. If he was genuinely going to have a poke around Clerkenwell for anyone who remembered the dead man who claimed to have killed Margot Bamborough, it would help if he knew the man's real name, and as Janice Beattie was still in Dubai, his only recourse was Irene Hickson. The rain was as heavy as ever. Minute to minute, he postponed the call to Irene, watching traffic moving through the rippling sheets of rain, pedestrians navigating the puddle-pocked streets, and thinking about the long-ago death of a young redcoat who'd slipped, knocked her head, and drowned in a swimming pool. Water everywhere, Bill Talbot had written in his astrological notebook. It had taken Strike some effort to decipher that particular passage. He'd concluded that Talbot was referring to a cluster of water signs, apparently connected with the death of the unknown Scorpio. Why, Strike asked himself now, sipping his tea, was Scorpio a water sign? Scorpions lived on land, in heat. Could they even swim? He remembered the large fish sign Talbot had used in the notebook for Irene, which at one point he described as Cetus. Picking up his mobile, Strike googled the word. The constellation Cetus, he read, known also as the Whale, was named for a sea monster slain by Perseus when saving Andromeda from the sea god Poseidon. It resided in a region of the sky known as the Sea, due to the presence there of many other water-associated constellations, including Pisces, Aquarius the water-bearer, and Capricorn, the fish-tailed goat. Water everywhere. The astrological notes were starting to tangle themselves around his thought processes, like an old net snagged in a propeller. A pernicious mixture of sense and nonsense, they mirrored, in Strike's opinion, the appeal of astrology itself, with its flattering, comforting promise that your petty concerns were of interest to the wide universe, and that the stars or the spirit world would guide you where your own hard work and reason couldn't. Enough, he told himself sternly. Pressing Irene's number on his mobile, he waited, listening to her phone ringing and visualizing it beside the bowl of potpourri in the over-decorated hall with the pink-flowered wallpaper and the thick pink carpet. At exactly the point where he'd decided, with a mixture of relief and regret, that she wasn't in, she answered.
4459,
she trilled, making it into a kind of jingle. Joan, too, always answered her landline by telling the caller the number they'd just dialed.
Is that Mrs. Hickson? Speaking.
It's Cormoran Strike here,
Oh, hello,
she yelped, sounding startled.
I wondered whether you might be able to help me, said Strike, taking out his notebook and opening it. When we last met, you mentioned a patient of the St. John's practice who you thought might have been called Apton or Applethorpe.
Oh, yes.
Who claimed to have
killed Margot, yes,
she interrupted him.
He stopped Dorothy in broad daylight.
Yes, but she thought it was a load of rubbish. I said to her, what if he really did, Dorothy? I haven't been able to find anyone of that name who lived in the area in 1974, said Strike loudly. So I wondered whether you might have misremembered his
Possibly yes, I might have done, said Irene. Well, it's been a long time, hasn't it? Have you tried directory inquiries?
Not directory inquiries, she corrected herself immediately.
Online records and things.
It's difficult to do a search with the wrong name, said Strike, just managing to keep his tone free of exasperation or sarcasm. I'm right by Clerkenwell Road at the moment. I think you said he lived there.
Well, he was always hanging around there, so I assume so.
He was registered with your practice, wasn't he?
Do you remember his first... let me think. It was something like Gilbert or... No, I can't remember, I'm afraid. Applethorpe, Appleton, Apton... Everyone knew him locally by sight because he looked so peculiar. Long beard, filthy, blah, blah, blah. And sometimes he had his kid with him, said Irene, warming up. Really funny-looking kid.
Yes, you said, with massive ears. He might still be alive, the son, but he's probably, you know.
Strike waited, but apparently he was supposed to infer the end of the sentence by Irene's silence.
Probably, he prompted. Oh, you know. In a place.
In
a home or something,
she said, a little impatiently, as though Strike were being obtuse.
He was never going to be right, was he, with a druggy father and a retarded mother? I don't care what Jan says. Jan hasn't got the same... Well, it's not her fault. Her family was different standards. And she likes to look in front of strangers. Well, we all do, but after all, you're after the truth, aren't you?
Strike noted the fine needle of malice directed at her friend, glinting among the discontented phrases.
"Have you found Duckworth?"
Irene asked, jumping subject.
"Douthwaite. Oh, what am I like? I keep doing that. Ha 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 ha!"
However little pleased she'd been to hear from him, he was at least someone to talk to.
I'd love to know what happened to him, I really would. He was a fishy character, if ever there was one. Jan played it down with you, but she was a bit disappointed when he turned out to be gay, you know. She had a soft spot for him. Well, she was very lonely when I first knew her. We used to try and set her up, Eddie and I. Yes, you said, but men didn't want to take on a kid, and Jan was a bit, you know, when a woman's been alone. I don't mean desperate, but clingy. Larry didn't mind, but Larry wasn't exactly. I had one other thing I wanted to ask. Only he wouldn't marry her either. He'd been through a bad divorce. It's about Leamington Spa. You have checked Bognor Regis?
Excuse me, said Strike.
For Douthwaite. Because he went to Bognor Regis, didn't he? To a holiday camp.
Clacton-on-Sea, said Strike. Unless he went to Bognor Regis as well.
As well as what?
Jesus fucking Christ. What makes you think Douthwaite was ever in Bognor Regis? Strike asked, slowly and clearly, rubbing his forehead.
I thought, wasn't he there at some point?
Not as far as I'm aware, but we know he worked in Clacton-on-Sea in the mid-80s.
Oh, it must have been that, yes. Someone must have told me that. They're all old-fashioned seaside, you know.
Strike seemed to remember he'd asked both Irene and Janice whether they had any idea where Douthwaite had gone after he left Clerkenwell, and that both had said they didn't know.
"How did you know he went to work in Clacton-on-Sea?" he asked. "Jan told me," said Irene, after a tiny pause. "Yes, Jan would have told me. She was his neighbour, you know. She was the one who knew him. Yes, I think she tried to find out where he'd gone after he left Percival Road, because she was worried about him."
"But this was 11 years later," said Strike.
"What was?"
"He didn't go to Clacton-on-Sea until 11 years after he left Percival Road," said Strike. "When I asked you both if you knew where he'd gone."
"Well, you meant now, didn't you?" said Irene. "Where is he now? I've no idea. Have you looked into that Leamington Spa business, by the way?"
Then she laughed and said, "All these seaside places.
No, wait, it isn't seaside, is it? Not Leamington Spa. But you know what I mean. Water. I do love water. It's Greenwich. Eddie knew I'd love this house when he spotted it for sale. Was there anything in that Leamington Spa thing, or was Jan making it up?"
"Mrs. Beattie wasn't making it up," said Strike. "Mr. Ramage definitely saw her missing."
"Oh, I didn't mean Jan would make it up. No, I don't mean that," said Irene, instantly contradicting herself. "I just mean, you know, odd place for Margot to turn up, Leamington. Have you found any connection?" she asked airily. "Or..."
"Not yet," said Strike. "You haven't remembered anything about Margot and Leamington Spa, have you?"
"Me? Goodness, no. How should I know why she'd go there?"
"Well, sometimes people do remember things after we've talked to.
Have you spoken to Jan since?"
"No," said Strike. "Do you know when she's back from Dubai?"
"No," said Irene. "All right for some, isn't it? I wouldn't mind some sunshine. The winter we're... But it's wasted on Jan. She doesn't sunbathe. And I wouldn't fancy the flight all that way in economy, which is how she has to. I wonder how she's getting on. 6 weeks with her daughter-in-law. Doesn't matter how well you get on, that's a long..."
"Well, I better let you get on, Mrs. Hickson."
"Oh, all right," she said. "Yes, well, best of luck with everything."
"Thank you," he said, and hung up. The rain pattered on the window. With a sigh, Strike retired to the cafe bathroom for a long overdue pee. He was just paying his bill when he spotted the man in the Sonic the Hedgehog sweatshirt walking past the window, now on the same side of the street as the cafe. He was heading back the way he'd come, two bulging bags of Tesco shopping hanging from his hands, moving with that same odd, rocking side-to-side gait, his soaking hair flat to his skull, his mouth slightly open. Strike's eyes followed him as he passed, watching the rain drip off the bottom of his shopping bags and from the lobes of his particularly large ears.
Chapter 38. So long in secret cabin there he held her captive to his sensual desire, till that with timely fruit her belly swelled, and bore a boy unto that savage sire. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. Asking himself whether he could possibly have got as lucky as he hoped, Strike threw a tip on the table and hurried outside into the driving rain, pulling on his coat as he went. If the mentally impaired adult in the sopping sonic sweatshirt was indeed the big-eared child once marched around these streets by his eccentric parent, he'd have been living in this corner of Clerkenwell for 40 years. Well, people did that, of course, Strike reflected, particularly if they had support there and if their whole world was a few familiar streets. The man was still within sight, heading stolidly towards Clerkenwell Road in the pelting rain, neither speeding up nor making any attempt to prevent himself becoming progressively more sodden. Strike turned up his coat collar and followed. A short distance down St. John Street, Strike's target turned right past a small ironmonger's on the corner and headed into Albemarle Way, the short street with an old red telephone box at the other end and tall, unbroken buildings on either side. Strike's interest quickened. Just past the ironmonger's, the man set down both of his shopping bags on the wet pavement and took out a door key. Strike kept walking, because there was nowhere to hide, but made a note of the door number as he passed. Was it possible that the late Applethorpe had lived in this very flat? Hadn't Strike thought that Albemarle Way presented a promising place to lie in wait for a victim? Not perhaps as good as Passing Alley, nor as convenient as the flats along Jerusalem Passage, but better by far than busy Clerkenwell Green, where Talbot had been convinced that Margot had struggled with a disguised Dennis Creed. Strike heard the front door close behind the large-eared man and double-backed. The dark blue door needed painting. A small push-button bell was beside it, beneath which was stuck the printed name, Athorne. Could this be the name Irene had misremembered as Applethorpe, Appleton, or Apton? Then Strike noticed that the man had left the key in the lock. With a feeling that he might have been far too dismissive of the mysterious ways of the universe, Strike pulled out the key and pressed the doorbell, which rang loudly inside. For a moment or two, nothing happened. Then the door opened again, and there stood the man in the wet sonic sweatshirt.
"You left this in the lock," said Strike, holding out the key.
The man addressed the third button of Strike's overcoat rather than look him in the eye.
"I did that before, and Claire said not to again," he mumbled, holding out his hand for the key, which Strike gave him.
The man began to close the door.
"My name's Cormoran Strike. I wonder whether I could come in and talk to you about your father," Strike said, not quite putting his foot in the door, but preparing to do so should it be required.
The other's big-eared face stood out, pale, against the dark hall.
"My dad Gwillem's dead." "Yes," said Strike. "I know."
"He carried me on his shoulders."
"Did he?"
"Yeah, Mum told me."
"Do you live alone?"
"I live with Mum."
"Is her name Claire?"
"No, Deborah."
"I'm a detective," said Strike, pulling a card out of his pocket. "My name's Cormoran Strike, and I'd really like to talk to your mum, if that's okay."
The man didn't take the card, but looked at it out of the corner of his eye. Strike suspected that he couldn't read.
"Will that be all right?"
Strike asked, as the cold rain continued to fall.
"Yeah, okay. You can come in,"
said the other, still addressing Strike's coat button, and he opened the door fully to admit the detective. Without waiting to see whether Strike was following, he headed up the dark staircase inside. Strike felt some qualms about capitalizing on the vulnerabilities of a man like Athorne, but the prospect of looking around what he now strongly suspected was the flat in which the self-proclaimed killer of Margot Bamborough had been living in 1974 was irresistible. After wiping his feet carefully on the doormat, Strike closed the door behind him, spotting as he did so a couple of letters lying on the floor, which the son of the house had simply walked over. One of them carried a wet footprint. Strike picked up the letters, then climbed the bare wooden stairs, over which hung a naked, non-functioning light bulb. As he climbed, Strike indulged himself with a fantasy of a flat which nobody other than the inhabitants had entered for 40 years, with locked cupboards and rooms, or even, it had been known to happen, a skeleton lying in open view. For a split second, as he stepped out onto the landing, his hopes surged. The oven in the tiny kitchen straight ahead looked as though it dated from the 70s, as did the brown wall tiles. But unfortunately, from a detective point of view, the flat looked neat and smelled fresh and clean. There were even recent Hoover marks on the old carpet, which was patterned in orange and brown swirls. The Tesco bag sat waiting to be unpacked on lino that was scuffed, but that had been recently washed. To Strike's right stood an open door into a small sitting room. The man he'd followed was standing there, facing a much older woman, who was sitting crocheting in an armchair beside the window. She looked, as well she might, shocked to see a large stranger standing in her hall.
"He wants to talk to you," announced the man.
"Only if you're comfortable with that, Mrs. Haythorne,"
Strike called from the landing. He wished Robin was with him. She was particularly good at putting nervous women at their ease. He remembered that Janice had said that this woman was agoraphobic.
"My name's Cormoran Strike, and I wanted to ask a few questions about your husband. But if you're not happy, of course, I'll leave immediately."
"I'm cold," said the man loudly.
"Change your clothes," his mother advised him. "You've got wet. Why don't you wear your coat?"
"Too tight," he said. "You silly woman."
He turned and walked out of the room past Strike, who stood back to let him pass. Gwilhelm's son disappeared into a room opposite, on the door of which the name Samhain appeared in painted wooden letters. Samhain's mother didn't appear to enjoy eye contact any more than her son did. At last, addressing Strike's knees, she said,
"All right, come in then."
"Thanks very much."
Two budgerigars, one blue, one green, chirruped in a cage in the corner of the sitting room. Samhain's mother had been crocheting a patchwork blanket. A number of completed woolen squares were piled onto the side windowsill beside her, and a basket of wools sat at her feet. A huge jigsaw mat was spread out on a large ottoman in front of the sofa. It bore a two-thirds completed puzzle of unicorns. As far as tidiness went, the sitting room compared very favourably with Gregory Talbot's.
"You've got some letters," Strike said, and he held up the damp envelopes to show her.
"You open them,"
she said.
"I don't think you open them,"
she repeated. She had the same big ears as Samhain and the same slight underbite. These imperfections notwithstanding, there was a prettiness in her soft face and in her dark eyes. Her long, neatly plaited hair was white. She had to be at least 60, but her smooth skin was that of a much younger woman. There was a strangely otherworldly air about her as she sat, plying her crochet hook beside the rainy window, shut away from the world. Strike wondered whether she could read. He felt safe to open the envelopes that were clearly junk mail, and did so.
"You've been sent the seed catalogue," he said, showing her, "and a letter from a furniture shop."
"I don't want them,"
said the woman beside the window, still talking to Strike's legs.
"You can sit down," she added.
He sidled carefully between the sofa and the ottoman, which, like Strike himself, was far too big for this small room. Having successfully avoided nudging the enormous jigsaw, he took a seat at a respectful distance from the crocheting woman.
"This one," said Strike, referring to the last letter, "is for Claire Spencer. Do you know her?"
The letter didn't have a stamp. Judging by the address on the back, the letter was from the ironmonger downstairs.
"Claire's our social worker," she said. "You can open it."
"I don't think I should do that," said Strike. "I'll leave it for Claire." "You're Deborah, is that right?"
"Yes,"
she murmured. Samhain appeared in the door. He was now barefoot, but wearing dry jeans and a fresh sweatshirt with Spider-Man on the front.
"I'm going to put things in the fridge," he announced, and disappeared again.
"Samhain does the shopping now,"
Deborah said, with a glance at Strike's shoes. Though timid, she didn't seem averse to talking to him.
"Deborah, I'm here to ask you about Gwilhelm," Strike said.
"He's not here."
"No,
he died."
"Yes," said Strike. "I'm sorry. I'm really here because of a doctor who used to work."
"Dr. Brenner,"
she said at once.
"You remember Dr. Brenner?"
said Strike, surprised.
I didn't like him, she said.
Well, I want to ask you about a different doc. Samson reappeared at the sitting room door and said loudly to his mother,
Do you want a hot chocolate or not?
Yes, she said.
Do you want a hot chocolate or not?
Samson demanded of Strike. Yes, please, Strike said, on the principle that all friendly gestures should be accepted in such situations. Samson lumbered out of sight. Pausing in her crocheting, Deborah pointed at something straight ahead of her and said,
That's Gwilym, there.
Strike looked around. An Egyptian ankh, the symbol of eternal life, had been drawn on the wall behind the old TV. The walls were pale yellow everywhere except behind the ankh, where a patch of dirty green survived. In front of the ankh, on top of the flat top television set, was a black object which Strike at first glance took for a vase. Then he spotted the stylized dove on it, realizing that it was an urn, and understood, finally, what he was being told.
Ah, said Strike, those are Gwilym's ashes, are they? I told Tudor to get the one with the bird because I like birds.
One of the budgerigars fluttered suddenly across the cage in a blur of bright green and yellow.
Who painted that?
Asked Strike, pointing at the ankh.
Gwilym,
said Deborah, continuing to dexterously ply her crochet hook. Samson re-entered the room, holding a tin tray.
Not on my jigsaw,
his mother warned him. But there was no other free surface.
Should I?
Offered Strike, gesturing towards the puzzle. But there was no space anywhere on the floor to accommodate it.
You close it, Deborah told him,
with a hint of reproach. And Strike saw that the jigsaw mat had wings, which could be fastened to protect the puzzle. He did so, and Samson laid the tray on top. Deborah struck her crochet hook carefully in the ball of wool, and accepted a mug of instant hot chocolate and a penguin biscuit from her son. Samson kept the Batman mug for himself. Strike sipped his drink and said,
Very nice,
not entirely dishonestly.
I make good hot chocolate, don't I, Deborah?
Said Samson, unwrapping a biscuit.
Yes, said Deborah, blowing on the surface of the hot liquid. I know this was a long time ago,
Strike began again,
but there was another doctor who worked with Dr. Brenner.
Oh, Joe Brenner was a dirty old man,
said Samson Athorne with a cackle. Strike looked at him in surprise. Samson directed his smirk at the closed jigsaw.
Why was he a dirty old man?
Asked the detective.
My Uncle Tudor told me, said Samson. Dirty old man. Is this mine?
He asked, picking up the envelope addressed to Claire Spencer.
No, said his mother. That's Claire's.
Why is it?
I think, said Strike, it's from your downstairs neighbour.
He's a bastard,
said Samson, putting the letter back down.
He made us throw everything away, didn't he, Deborah?
I like it better now, said Deborah mildly. It's good now.
Strike allowed a moment or two to pass, in case Samson had more to add, then asked,
Why did Uncle Tudor say Joseph Brenner was a dirty old man?
Tudor knew everything about everyone, said Deborah placidly.
Who was Tudor? Strike asked her.
Gwilym's brother, said Deborah. He always knew about people round here.
Does he still visit you? Asked Strike, suspecting the answer.
Pass the way to the other side, said Deborah,
as though it was one long word.
He used to buy us shopping. He took Sammy to play football and to the swimming. I do all the shopping now,
piped up Samson.
Sometimes I don't want to do the shopping, but if I don't, I get hungry. And Deborah says, It's your fault there's nothing to eat. So then I go shopping.
Good move, said Strike.
The three of them drank their hot chocolate.
Dirty old man, Joe Brenner,
repeated Samson more loudly.
Uncle Tudor used to tell me some stories. Old Betty and the one who wouldn't pay. Dirty old Joe Brenner. I didn't like him, said Deborah quietly. He wanted me to take my pants off.
Really? Said Strike.
While this had surely been a question of a medical examination, he felt uncomfortable.
Yes, to look at me, said Deborah. I didn't want it. Gwilym wanted it. But I don't like men, I don't know, looking at me.
No, well, I can understand that, said Strike. You were ill, were you?
Gwilym said I had to,
was her only response. If he'd still been in the Special Investigation Branch, there would have been a female officer with him for this interview. Strike wondered what her IQ was. Did you ever meet Dr. Bamborough? He asked. She was, he hesitated, a lady doctor.
I've never seen a lady doctor, said Deborah,
with what sounded like regret. Do you know whether Gwilym ever met Dr. Bamborough?
She died, said Deborah.
Yes, said Strike, surprised. People think she died, but no one knows for sh— One of the budgerigars made the little bell hanging from the top of its cage tinkle. Both Deborah and Samhain looked around, smiling.
Which one was it?
Deborah asked Samhain.
Bluey, he said. Bluey's cleverer than Billy Bob.
Strike waited for them to lose interest in the budgerigars, which took a couple of minutes. When both Athorn's attention had returned to their hot chocolates, he said, Dr. Bamborough disappeared, and I'm trying to find out what happened to her. I've been told that Gwilym talked about Dr. Bamborough after she went missing. Deborah didn't respond. It was hard to know whether she was listening or deliberately ignoring him.
I heard, said Strike.
There was no point not saying it. This was the whole reason he was here, after all.
That Gwilym told people he killed her.
Deborah glanced at Strike's left ear, then back at her hot chocolate.
You're like Tudor, she said. You know what's what? He probably did, she added placidly.
You mean, said Strike carefully, he told people about it. She didn't answer. Or you think he killed the doctor?
Was my dad Gwilym doing magic on her?
Samhain inquired of his mother.
My dad Gwilym didn't kill that lady. My uncle Tudor told me what really happened.
What did your uncle tell you? Asked Strike, turning from mother to son. But Samhain had just crammed his mouthful of chocolate biscuit, so Deborah continued the story.
He woke me up one time when I was asleep, said Deborah, and it was dark. He said, I killed a lady by mistake. I said, you've had a bad dream. He said, no, no, I've killed her, but I didn't mean it.
Woke you up to tell you, did he?
Woke me up, all upset.
But you think it was just a bad dream?
Yes,
said Deborah. But then, after a moment or two, she said,
but maybe he did kill her, because he could do magic.
I see, said Strike untruthfully, turning back to Samhain. What did your Uncle Tudor say happened to the lady doctor?
I can't tell you that, said Samhain,
suddenly grinning.
Uncle Tudor said not to tell. Never.
But he grinned with a puckish delight at having a secret.
My dad Gwilym did that,
he went on, pointing at the ankh on the wall.
Yes,
said Strike. Your mum told me.
I don't like it,
said Deborah placidly, looking at the ankh.
I'd like it if the walls were all the same. I like it,
said Samhain,
because it's different from the other walls. You silly woman,
he added abstractedly. Did Uncle Tudor, began Strike, but Samhain, who'd finished his biscuit, now got to his feet and left the room, pausing in the doorway to say loudly,
Claire says it's nice I still got things of Gwilym's.
He disappeared into his bedroom and closed the door firmly behind him. With a feeling he'd just seen a gold sovereign bounce down a grate, Strike turned back to Deborah. Do you know what Tudor said happened to the doctor? She shook her head, uninterested. Strike looked hopefully back towards Samhain's bedroom door. It remained closed. Can you remember how Gwilym thought he killed the doctor? He asked Deborah.
He said his magic killed her, then took her away.
Took her away, did it? Samhain's bedroom door suddenly opened again, and he trudged back into the room, holding a coverless book in his hand.
"Deborah, is this my dad Gwilym's magic book, is it?"
"That's it," said Deborah.
She'd finished her hot chocolate now. Setting down the empty mug, she picked up her crochet again. Samhain held the book wordlessly out to Strike. Though the cover had come off, the title page was intact. The Magus by Francis Barrett. Strike had the impression that being shown this book was a mark of esteem, and he therefore flicked through it with an expression of deep interest, his main objective to keep Samhain happy and close at hand for further questioning. A few pages inside was a brown smear. Strike halted the cascade of pages to examine it more closely. It was, he suspected, dried blood, and had been wiped across a few lines of writing. "This I will say no more, to wit, that those who walk in their sleep do, by no other guide than the spirit of the blood, that is, of the outward man, walk up and down, perform business, climb walls, and manage things that are otherwise impossible to those that are awake."
"You can do magic with that book," said Samhain. "But it's my book, because it was my dad Gwilym's, so it's mine now."
And he held out his hand before Strike could examine it any further, suddenly jealous of his possession. When Strike handed it back, Samhain clutched the book to his chest with one hand and bent to take a third chocolate biscuit.
"No more, Sammy," said Deborah.
"I went in the rain and got them," said Samhain loudly. "I can have what I want, silly woman, stupid woman."
He kicked the ottoman, but it hurt his bare foot, and this increased his sudden childish anger. Pink-faced and truculent, he looked around the room. Strike suspected he was looking for something to disarrange, or perhaps break. His choice landed on the budges.
"I'll open the cage,"
he threatened his mother, pointing at it. He let the Magus fall onto the sofa as he clambered onto the seat, looming over Strike.
"No, don't," said Deborah, immediately distressed. "Don't do that, Sammy." "And I'll open the window," said Samhain,
now trying to walk his way along the sofa seats, but blocked by Strike.
"Ha, ha, ha, you stupid woman!" "No, Samhain, don't,"
said Deborah, frightened.
"You don't want to open the cage," said Strike, standing up and moving in front of it. "You wouldn't want your budgies to fly away. They won't come back."
"I know they won't," said Samhain. "The last ones didn't."
His anger seemed to subside as fast as it had come in the face of rational opposition. Still standing on the sofa, he said grumpily,
"I went out in the rain. I got them."
"Have you got Clara's phone number?" Strike asked Deborah.
"In the kitchen," she said,
without asking why he wanted it.
"Can you show me where that is?"
Strike asked Samhain, although he knew perfectly well. The whole flat was as big as Irene Hickson's sitting room. Samhain frowned at Strike's midriff for a few moments, then said,
"All right, then."
He walked the length of the sofa, jumped off the end with a crash that made the bookcase shake, and then lunged for the biscuits.
"Ha, ha, ha, ha,"
he taunted his mother, both hands full of penguins.
"I got 'em, silly woman, stupid woman!"
He walked out of the room. As Strike inched back out of the space between ottoman and sofa, he stooped to pick up the Magus, which Samhain had dropped, and slid it under his coat. Crocheting peacefully by the window, Deborah Athorn noticed nothing. A short list of names and numbers was attached to the kitchen wall with a drawing pin. Strike was pleased to see that several people seemed interested in Deborah and Samhain's welfare.
"Who are these people?"
he asked. But Samhain shrugged, and Strike was confirmed in his suspicion that Samhain couldn't read, no matter how proud he was of the Magus. He took a photo of the list with his phone, then turned to Samhain.
"It would really help me if you could remember what your Uncle Tudor said happened to the Lady Doctor."
"Ha, ha, ha, ha,"
said Samhain, who was unwrapping another penguin.
"I'm not telling."
"Your Uncle Tudor must have really trusted you, to tell you."
Samhain chewed in silence for a while, then swallowed and said, with a proud little upwards jerk of the chin,
"Yeah, it's good to have people you can trust with important information."
Samhain seemed pleased with this statement. He ate his biscuit and for the first time glanced at Strike's face. The detective had the impression that Samhain was enjoying another man's presence in the flat.
"I did that," he said suddenly,
and walking to the sink, he picked up a small clay pot, which was holding a washing-up brush and a sponge.
"I go to class on Tuesdays and we make stuff. Ranjit teaches us."
"That's excellent," said Strike, taking it from him and examining it. "Where were you when your uncle told you what happened to Dr. Bamborough?"
"At the football," said Samhain. "And I made this," he told Strike,
prizing a wooden photo frame off the fridge where it had been attached with a magnet. The framed picture was a recent one of Deborah and Samhain, both of whom had a budgerigar perched on their finger.
"That's very good," said Strike, admiring it. "Yeah," said Samhain,
taking it back from him and slapping it on the fridge.
"Ranjit said it was the best one. We were at the football and I heard Uncle Tudor telling his friend." "Ah," said Strike. "And then he said to me, 'Don't you tell no one.'" "Right," said Strike. "But if you tell me, I can maybe help the doctor's family. They're really sad. They miss her."
Samhain cast another fleeting look at Strike's face.
"She can't come back now. People can't be alive again when they're dead." "No," said Strike. "But it's nice when their families know what happened and where they went." "My dad Gwilym died under the bridge."
"Yes."
"My uncle Tudor died in the hospital." "You see," said Strike. "It's good you know, isn't it?"
"Yeah,"
said Samhain. "I know what happened." "Exactly." "Uncle Tudor told me it was Nico and his boys done it."
It came out almost indifferently.
"You can tell her family," said Samhain, "but nobody else."
"Right," said Strike, whose mind was working very fast.
"Did Tudor know how Nico and the boys did it?"
"No, he just knew they did."
Samhain picked up another biscuit. He appeared to have no more to say.
Can I use your bathroom?"
"The bog?"
said Samhain, with his mouth full of chocolate.
"Yes, the bog," said Strike.
Like the rest of the flat, the bathroom was old but perfectly clean. It was papered in green, with a pattern of pink flamingos on it, which doubtless dated from the '70s, and now, 40 years later, was fashionably kitsch. Strike opened the bathroom cabinet, found a pack of razor blades, extracted one, and cut the blood-stained page of the Magus out with one smooth stroke, then folded it and slipped it in his pocket. Out on the landing, he handed Samhain the book back.
"You left it on the floor."
"Oh,"
said Samhain.
"Ta."
"You won't do anything to the budgers if I leave, will you?"
Samhain looked up at the ceiling, grinning slightly.
"Will you?" asked Strike.
"No,"
sighed Samhain at last. Strike returned to the doorway of the sitting room.
"I'll be off now, Mrs. Athorne," he said. "Thanks very much for talking to me."
"Goodbye,"
said Deborah, without looking at him. Strike headed downstairs and let himself back onto the street. Once outside, he stood for a moment in the rain, thinking hard. So unusually still was he that a passing woman turned to stare back at him. Reaching a decision, Strike turned left and entered the ironmonger's, which lay directly below the Athorne's flat. A sullen, grizzled, and aproned man behind the counter looked up at Strike's entrance. One of his eyes was larger than the other, which gave him an oddly malevolent appearance.
"Morning," said Strike briskly. "I've just come from the Athorne's upstairs. I gather you want to talk to Claire Spencer." "Who are you?"
asked the ironmonger, with a mixture of surprise and aggression.
"Friend of the family," said Strike. "Can I ask why you're putting letters to their social worker through their front door?" "Because they don't pick up their phones at the bloody social work department," snarled the ironmonger. "And there's no point talking to them, is there?" he added, pointing his finger at the ceiling. "Is there a problem I can help with?" "I doubt it," said the ironmonger shortly. "You're probably feeling pretty bloody pleased with the situation, are you, if you're a friend of the family?
Nobody is to put their hand in their pocket except me, eh? Quick bit of a cover-up and let someone else foot the bill, eh?
What cover-up would this be? Asked Strike. The ironmonger was only too willing to explain. The flat upstairs, he told Strike, had long been a health risk, crammed with the hoarded belongings of many years and a magnet for vermin, and in a just world it ought not to be he who was bearing the costs of living beneath a pair of actual morons.
You're talking about friends of mine, said Strike.
You do it then, snarled the ironmonger. You pay a bleeding fortune to keep the rats down. My ceiling's sagging under the weight of their filth. I've just been upstairs and it's perfectly because they mucked it out last month when I said I was going to bloody court, snarled the ironmonger. Cousins come down from Leeds when I threaten legal action. Nobody gives a shit until then. And I come back Monday morning and they've cleaned it all up, sneaky bastards.
Didn't you want the flat cleaned?
I want compensation for the money I've had to spend. Structural damage, bills to rent a kill. That pair shouldn't be living together without supervision. They're not fit. They should be in a home. If I have to take it to court, I will.
Bit of friendly advice, said Strike, smiling. If you behave in any way that could be considered threatening towards the Athorns, their friends will make sure it's you who ends up in court. Have a nice day, he added, heading for the door. The fact that the Athorns' flat had recently been mucked out by helpful relatives tended to suggest that Margot Bamborough's remains weren't hidden on the premises. On the other hand, Strike had gained a bloodstain and a rumour, which was considerably more than he'd had an hour ago. While still disinclined to credit supernatural intervention, he had to admit that deciding to eat breakfast on St. John Street that morning had been, at the very least, a most fortuitous choice.
Chapter 39. They thus beguile the way until the blustering storm is overblown. They cannot find that path which first was shown, but wander to and fro in ways unknown. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. Robin's alarm went off at 6:30 on Friday morning, in the middle of a dream about Matthew. He'd come to her in the Earl's Court flat and begged her to return to him, saying that he'd been a fool, promising he'd never again complain about her job, imploring her to admit that she missed what they'd once had. He'd asked her whether she honestly liked living in a rented flat, without the security and companionship of marriage, and in the dream Robin felt a pullback towards her old relationship, before it had become complicated by her job with Strike. He was a younger Matthew in the dream, a far kinder Matthew, and Sarah Shadlock was dismissed as a mistake, a blip, a meaningless error. In the background hovered Robin's flatmate, no longer the disengaged and courteous Max, but a pale, simpering girl who echoed Matthew's persuasions, who giggled when he looked at her and urged Robin to give him what he wanted. Only when she'd managed to silence her alarm and dispel the fog of sleep did Robin, who was lying face down on her pillow, realize how closely the dream flatmate had resembled Cynthia Phipps. Struggling to understand why she'd set her alarm so early, she sat up in bed, the cream walls of her bedroom a bluish mauve in the dawn light, then remembered that Strike had planned a full team meeting, the first in 2 months, and that he'd asked her to come in an hour earlier than the others again, so that they could discuss the Bamborough case before everyone else got there. Extremely tired, as she always seemed to be these days, Robin showered and dressed, fumbling over buttons, forgetting where she'd put her phone, realizing there was a stain on her sweater only when halfway upstairs to the kitchen, and generally feeling disgruntled at life and early starts. When she reached the upper floor, she found Max sitting at the dining table in his dressing gown, poring over a cookbook. The TV was on. The breakfast television presenter was asking whether Valentine's Day was an exercise in commercial cynicism or an opportunity to inject some much-needed romance into a couple's life. "Has Cormoran got any special dietary requirements?" Max asked her. And when Robin looked blank, he said, "For tonight, dinner."
"Oh," said Robin, "no, he'll eat anything."